papermen meet such interesting people. They know the lowdown, now it can be told. I'll tell you quite reliably off the record about some charming people I have known. For I meet politicians and grafters by the score, killers plain and fancy, it's really quite a bore. Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. They wallow in corruption, crime and gore. Ting-a-ling-ling, city desk, pull the press, extra, extra, read all about it, it's a mess, meets the test. Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. It's wonderful to represent the press.
And so the media project gets underway. It is a half hour of commentary and analysis, some insight into newsroom decision making from veterans in the field. And we welcome you to join us. I'm Rex Smith, the former editor of the Times Union, now with the Upstate American. And we are here with Ira Fussfeld, Judy Patrick, and Barbara Lombardo. Ira Fussfeld being the publisher emeritus of the Daily Freeman in Kingston and affiliated publications. Judy Patrick, formerly editor of the Daily Gazette in Schenectady, now vice president of the New York Press Association, and Barbara Lombardo, the former executive editor of the Saratogian and the Record of Troy. A lot of folks here who have a lot of years in the news business, and we can look at the last big story over the past couple of weeks and maybe envy those who are still active, because there was, among the many noteworthy events, there was the eclipse, and that gave people an opportunity to cover a big story where you would presume there wasn't controversy, but maybe there's controversy here about the coverage. Ira, being the senior guy in the room, what do you think?
Well, let me break this into two parts. One is that I could care less about the eclipse. I didn't watch it. I didn't want to watch it. I don't want to throw a damper on those people who did watch it and enjoyed it. More power to you, but I had no interest at all in watching it. But here's the journalism question I would ask. Did the media build up to the eclipse create the, I don't know if stir is the right word, but did it create the amount of interest that heretofore might not have occurred had there been a lot less pre-coverage?
Interesting.
I don't know if the media created coverage that wouldn't have been there, or excitement that wouldn't have been there, but that excitement was warranted. And you won't make people like me feel bad, Ira. I feel sorry for you.
Anyway.
I've been planning to see this, although my planning was quite poor, since 2017 when we had that partial eclipse in, and I went to the Schenectady Museum to watch it. And so I knew that it was coming. I kind of forgot exactly when. And I was glad for the publicity about it. This was a unique event because of the swath of the solar eclipses line through the United States, how many people could conceivably see it, how unusual that is. And I got to tell you, it was awesome.
So Barbara Lombardo is one person in favor of the nature of the media coverage. Ira Fussfeld opposed. Do you want to break the tie here,
yeah,
Judy Patrick?
Way, way, way too much hype. too much coverage. And I was glad I wasn't working, because it's almost like being assigned the weather story on a snowy day.
Yeah.
I think it definitely deserves some coverage, but at one point during the day, I said, isn't there any other news I can listen to?
Something to make you sad or make you smart or something important. It is not unimportant.
It is like
it's
the kumbaya moment. Everybody's looking up at the sky. I went for a run during the eclipse.
Did you wear glasses?
And the other thing is, everybody, wear your glasses. Make sure you got your glasses on. It's like, I went for a run, and like, my town was a ghost town. I understand that there were people who looked at the eclipse, that gathered together in their backyards and looked up at the sky. I just thought that was way too much. I've fallen for this so many times. Oh, I've got to get up at 2 o'clock in the morning to see a meteor shower, and been disappointed. And the people in Rochester, it was cloudy. There's a responsibility to cover such things, and it is a good news story. And, I went to the New York Times to look at their great photo coverage of it, and they went state by state. And, you know, when they got to Ohio, I go, yep, I've seen enough.
You've seen it.
I've seen enough people looking up at the sky.
And one postscript to that is, I had to be up here in Albany, New York on Tuesday, the day after the eclipse, and noticed as I was driving north that there was a lot of traffic driving driving south. And I thought, oh, there must be people coming back, but they'll be gone by the time I have to go home. No, the stop-and-go traffic all the way down south, so it took me an extra half hour to get home, just as if I wasn't annoyed enough about this eclipse.
Bah humbug, they say, exactly. Barbara. What do you think?
Yeah, if I had planned better, I probably wouldn't have gotten stuck in 5.5-hour traffic or 2 hours up, 5.5 hours back. But if one is interested in that kind of thing, it was an amazing experience to see, and it's a once-in-a-lifetime chance to see it. I would agree with you, Judy, on like some of the coverage was, because it was incessant, and because some of it was silly, over-the-top silly, but it was something special, and I think it was okay. What about you, Mr. Rex?
You know what? Actually, I avoided most of the coverage. I really wasn't.
Well,
I went out to try to see
too.
It. And, you know, we were at 90% totality where I live, just outside Troy. And, of course, the sky was cloudy, so I couldn't see much when I looked up with my dark glasses. But, you know, when you have, like NBC, they stationed the Today Show in the Museum of Natural History. Why? Because TV likes to have cool backdrops. And they had 13 reporters spread out across the country for coverage. Now, what event got 13 reporters coverage in recent months? I guess it is a good news story. And of course, there was science, and it's nice when people pay attention to science. But I'm just not sure that the value, I'm not sure there was an ROI on that. The return on investment, were people really watching because it was important, or were they watching just because they were told that it was important? So,
well, there's thousands and thousands of people, most of them on the Northway, from across the country, thought it was going to be cool enough to go out, regardless of media coverage. And the media, I think we would be rightfully called a bunch of old mean fuddy-duddies if we couldn't appreciate such a scientific phenomenon.
I think she just called us a bunch of
new
fuddy-duddies.
Yeah, and I would argue that the old most of the old fuddy-duddies, myself excluded, would have been looking forward to this. They've lived their lives, and this is something they've always wanted to see. No, again, you were talking about despite the media coverage, all those people were driving. I would say because of the media coverage, many of those people said, oh, this is something I have to see. And I wonder how many of them, while they said, oh, that was interesting, have to wonder whether it's taking 3 minutes out of their lives and driving 5 hours to do it was worth their time and effort.
Well, we'll ask our listeners. We're media at WAMCA.org, media at WAMCA.org, and you can share your thoughts.
I hope people write in about this.
All right. See whether you're on Team Barbara or...
And you have to understand, in my case, I wouldn't walk across the street to see fireworks either. So I'm a little bit
down
on
this. Oh, well, he is a mean old fuddy buddy.
Yeah, I'm down on this stuff.
You know what? I'm over fireworks, too.
Yeah.
Okay. We are the Media Project on WAMC. That's Ira Fussfeld, Barbara Lombardo, Judy Patrick, and I'm Rex Smith. We turn now to what's an interesting conversation. You folks who are listening on NPR, on your local NPR affiliate, may be aware of this because there's been some coverage. A senior editor on the business desk at NPR, Uri Berliner, wrote a column, basically, on a conservative-leaning website attacking NPR, really, a broad critique of how the network has covered some of the most important stories of our time. Uri Berliner writes, an open-minded spirit no longer exists with NPR, and now, predictably, we don't have an audience that reflects America. By the way, just by way of disclosure, Uri Berliner was a friend of mine long ago. We were classmates, actually. A very thoughtful guy who spent many years as a writer for a fine weekly on Long Island's East End, the Southampton Press, where he won a lot of awards from your organization, Judy, the New York Press Association. 25 years ago, he went to work for NPR. He's now a senior editor. And he says that he's tried in this 3,000-word piece, he says, well, I've tried to get this point across to senior management. I've been shut down. Nobody seems to be paying attention. But he complains that there is basically an effort that is too stringent at NPR to represent a diversity. In part as a result of that, he says, the coverage is not diverse in the sense that it doesn't reflect the conservatives and the Republicans as well as the Democrats. He notes that 87 people in the NPR newsroom in New York are Democrats, not one is a Republican. So the question is, what do we think of Uri Berliner's critique? Maybe we'll start this time, Judy, with you on your thought about Uri's angst.
So every newsroom is full of journalists with opinions about what the editors or what the management is doing, what stories they play, or how they play them, what they get assigned, what stories get canned. There's always, that's one of the beauties of being a journalist is you have opinions. I thought it was unfair for him to publish this without getting some response from NPR. Let's be clear. I mean, NPR has never had a huge conservative audience. They have tried to be middle of the road, but most people, when you ask them about NPR, well, they will say they do bend a little left.
We'll give you just a statistic that he cited. In 2011, 26% of listeners describe themselves as conservative, 23% as middle of the road, that's about equal, and 37% as liberal. So about almost one third, a little less than one third more liberal than conservative, let's say.
And the examples he cites as stories that were poorly covered would be the Hunter Biden laptop, for example. And there's a lot of controversy about how every news organization covered the Hunter Biden laptop story. But in some respects, what I took away from that column was he was criticizing NPR for not being both sides. That one of the things we've seen in the news industry lately following Trump has been to take away the focus on offering both sides all the time. And NPR was one of those that did that, that call out lies when they see them. And I thought that was part of the basis of his criticism.
Because the critique of both sidism is that there are not always two equally fair sides, two equally true sides to something. Sometimes you have to say what's true and what's not, right?
Exactly. And again, there's always somebody in your newsroom. I mean, there's always more than one person in your newsroom that disagrees with where you're headed. And NPR is trying to build its audience. It, like everybody else, has seen its audience decrease. They tend to skew older, and they're trying to build their audience with different kinds of programming, and some of the veteran reporters are not going to agree with it.
That's Barbara, before you speak, let me just go to the second statistic here that Uri cited, which is now, you know, I mentioned that previously, say a dozen years ago, it skewed liberal, but not terribly. Now, two-thirds of NPR listeners say they were very or somewhat liberal, while only 11% say they're somewhat conservative, 21% middle of the road. So that cites as evidence that the audience has shifted, and he blames the coverage for that.
I think that's pretty good evidence, actually, and that the approach of NPR seems to be not merely to report in depth and tell all the relevant sides of an issue, but to try to affect change. So they're choosing stories that will somehow be a catalyst for change. I see a related but separate issue of when somebody who works for you, so this for any company that you might be working for, if there's somebody who, as Judy said, is going to disagree with the decisions made by management, and sometimes they are decisions management might have goofed up on, but if you are disagreeing with the decisions made by management, do you continue to work for them and then go public, because he went outside NPR to publish his piece without any warning to his bosses?
Yeah.
I wanted to hear what he had to say, and yet I found it troubling, maybe with my manager mind, of whether that was appropriate, probably was not appropriate way to express your opinions.
So you've been a CEO at your company, Ira, and if you had somebody who had tried to talk to you and you didn't get around to speaking to them, and then they went out into the public and made their point, what would you think of that?
Well, it drives you crazy. And it's as Barbara points out, it's not just our industry. And any CEO of a company can't be happy when somebody goes public about a perceived wrong in their company. It does not bother me today as it might have bothered me 10 or 15 years ago for NPR or any other news organization to be pinpointed as leaning in a certain direction, whichever direction you want to choose. I've been listening to NPR a long time, but I don't listen to it religiously, and so I wouldn't want to give it an audit based on an anecdotal evidence. But generally speaking, NPR has always been known as a liberal news source, and that they do very good work because they have the ability to do long-form work, and the broadcasters seem to be very erudite and very knowledgeable. But I don't know that anymore, and we've discussed it on this program, both sidism, for quite a while. I don't know that that's necessarily wrong for them to be guilty, quote unquote, of what this fellow is alleging with NPR. I think NPR is respected. If you walk into an NPR newscast with some knowledge of what NPR is all about, each listener can weigh his or her own way about what they have just heard. But I'm more concerned about this guy doing what he did than what he had to say.
Well, but don't you think that there is a difficulty in a taxpayer-supported entity, not-for-profit as well, since that's how we support not-for-profits, by making them tax-exempt in this country? Isn't that an entity that shouldn't have an overt bias if we're expecting tax dollars to help subsidize?
That's the best argument to counter mine, I think, is that this is a public company getting public funds and should be more representative of the entire landscape.
Yet I can speak to the other side of that, though, too, you know, because if you have one side in the American political debate that does not care about facts, and I'm sorry, I think that does characterize a lot of the Republican Party these days, that there is an aversion to factual presentation. And so it is very hard to be fair if your standard is truth-telling. Isn't that right? I mean, how do you go about reporting fairly? How do you lure those people on the right who now have been tuning out NPR if they are buying Donald Trump's lies, which they are? And that makes it very hard.
You know, I think one of the reasons the percentage of conservative people who listen to NPR has fallen is because Donald Trump spent a lot of time criticizing places like NPR, CNN, and so he's shoved them towards right-wing media. You can rest assured that Donald Trump and his supporters are going to use this, and in fact they already have, to continue their attack on NPR and media outlets like it, and to call for cutting the funding for it. It's always been an issue, and it will continue to be an issue. I think what you need to do is just listen to NPR and decide for yourself.
Yeah, I can see, however, what's going to happen. There are going to be congressional hearings where Uri Berliner is going to be called to testify on legislation or appropriations bills, probably, that would strip the funding from public broadcasting. And then what do you do if you're the boss and Uri works for you and you're going to be saying, you're going to go testify in Congress and you're denigrating our funding in that way?
And then when the Democrats come in, they'll reverse it and their funding will be restored.
That's a great way to build a budget every year.
That's right.
It?
Yeah.
How would you handle it locally if somebody who worked for the WAMC station, and I'll ask Ira's opinion first as a member of the board, if somebody pulled an Uri locally, how would you handle
it? You're talking about a current employee did that?
Yes, of a
I couldn't answer that. I know how I'd feel about it, but I couldn't answer that because I don't know the ins and outs of the employee handbook and about what an employee is or isn't allowed to do. But I think that the money issue is a significant one that Rex raised. And my position, and particularly as a member of the board, and I've talked about it on this program, I don't believe that government, I don't like government interfering by providing us money. It's come up recently because more and more newspapers are now considering getting financial help from the government, whether it's tax breaks or something else like that. I just feel that if you are a news organization, you should stand on your own merits. It would clobber public radio if it was to lose any funding from the government. But as they used to say, one of my ad directors used to say, there's no such thing as half a whore. So,
but Barbara raises a really interesting First Amendment issue, especially for an industry that prides itself on abiding by the First Amendment. And so does someone in your newsroom have the right to say whatever they want, wherever they want? We deal with this issue on social media. Is it bad form to go on social media and criticize a colleague's story, for example?
Well, I would say that it is, but I've been the unfortunate leader of a newsroom where I had situations like that. For example, we had Times Union reporters, when I was the editor of the Times Union, on social media criticizing the newspaper for not having a contract in place with the union, leafleting at what was then called the Times Union Center, now MVP Arena, against the newspaper. And that's a hard thing to swallow. But there is a First Amendment right that is that you cannot limit by contract. You can put an employee handbook and say, well, you know, this is the expectation. But that's a shaky ground that you're on as a manager.
But complaining about contract negotiations is more, although it's annoying to the management, it is more reasonable, if that's the right word, for that to occur. That's going to happen in any business when they're in the middle of prolonged negotiations and the employees are going to finally say, we're going to have to bring this to the attention of the public. This is not the content. That has nothing to do with the content of your product.
Right. And so what do you do? That's an interesting question. If you're now paid by that news organization and you say, well, for example, Barbara, you and I both were leading the newsroom of the Troy paper, which now is a fraction of what it was. And you could imagine somebody now on that payroll saying, boy, we don't cover anything very well anymore. And that would be hard to swallow.
They might be saying it amongst themselves and their friends, but not to say it publicly. Or it's something, Strudy said, listen or read for yourself and you can judge how well or poorly they're doing. I don't know if Uri has thought through the ramifications of what he said. What's his motivations, which may or may not even be relevant. It's more what's the effect of what he's doing that may not be a positive thing, as you're pointing out with the budgeting.
The amount of coverage and the scope of the coverage at publications and broadcasters who have been reduced in staff size because of the economy and the change in the industry is self-evident in the product. In other words, if a reporter went online and said, you know, my paper stinks, it doesn't cover as much as it used to, who can argue with that? Yes, that's accurate.
Yeah. That's accurate. That's true. By the way, listener Adam writes in, I'd like to know his suggestion on how any media can cover Trump and or his supporters without displaying a left of Trump bias, while Trump's playbook is to normalize fascism as being compatible with our Constitution and to sell dangerous lies as valid opinions. Well, and to sell Bibles. But
and sneakers.
And sneakers, yes.
Wine, steak.
Vodka.
Yeah, I think that's a valid point. And the way Uri wraps up his piece is what we in the news business would say, like, what's the news angle, the current news angle? And he mentions that NPR has a brand new CEO.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's looking ahead of, okay, here's a new CEO. Here's the problems as I have seen it and have tried to express internally, which may or may not be valid. So what's going to happen next?
By the way, one of the things that he's upset about is the amount of focus on diversity, equity, inclusion in the newsroom, because the previous CEO referred to that as our North Star at NPR. And he hopes that that will not be the North Star for the new CEO. Points out that there are employee resource or affinity groups based upon identity, including not only NPR Pride for LGBTQIA employees, but also the Marginalized Genders and Intersex People of Color mentorship program, Mi Gente, which is for Latinx employees, NPR Noir for Black employees, Southwest Asians and North Africans at NPR, UMA for Muslim-identifying employees, Women, Gender Expansive, and Transgender People in Technology throughout public media, and KEVR, which is Jewish Heritage and Culture at NPR. So, you know, we see this sort of identification by interest and by sectoring of people by identity all through society. And we're seeing it in a workplace as well. He says that that is reflected then in news judgment inappropriately.
He mentions Latinx and he said, why are we at NPR using that term when people of Latin descent don't like it? I don't know how true that is or not true, but he's trying to throw in some food for thought about what they're doing.
You know, I was surprised he mentioned the political registration of the people at NPR headquarters. That all of them were Democrats. I find that hard to believe, to be honest.
Yeah, that's
because most
amazing.
Of the journalists I know are registered as unaffiliated.
Uh-huh.
I believe.
But at the end of the day, isn't it great? Isn't it great that this one person feels he's so smarter than everybody else that he has to write this doctrine?
There's 10 of them in every newsroom.
Yeah, is exactly
your
right.
Your newsroom still had 10.
No, you know, that is exactly right.
Bunch of bitter managers here, folks, who have dealt with tough newsroom situations. It is. We hire people in newsrooms to be questioning and dubious because that is what journalism requires. And then
they do it.
They do it to us.
I remember talking to a labor lawyer, and I said, you know, at least I don't have to negotiate with the Teamsters. And he said, the Teamsters are a lot easier to negotiate with because all they're interested in is money. You deal with the newspaper guild and you're going to talk about 100 of others sidebar issues. And that reminds me of this reporter.
Yeah, that's very interesting. Well, we would welcome your thoughts, people. Media@wamc.org is how we do that. Media@wamc.org. And we'd love to hear that. And finally today, just like to make a point, we've talked a lot about not-for-profit newsrooms here, which, of course, public radio is. There are nonprofit newsrooms covering state government now in all 50 states. This is a development that has been growing. It now happens. They are banded together by a sort of loose consortium, which is called States Newsroom, a nonprofit operation, and they absorb these. For example, in New York, we have New York Focus, on which board I serve. And it's a small newsroom, but they do have, they do significant coverage in Vermont. It's Vermont Digger, which is a fine newsroom. There's one in Massachusetts, the name of which I can't quite recall. So it's just an interesting notion, but nonprofit journalism still requires revenue. And that's not an easy thing to come by, right?
Do you know if the State's Newsroom is related to State's News Service, which is...
No, sir, it's not. It's not. Used okay. to be. Yep, that was the newsroom based in Washington.
It was
Washington.
Based in Washington, but you would call them up and say, we need a story about our congressman, and they would produce it.
Yeah, that was really a quite useful service.
It was.
Those decades back. Well, we are out of time anyway. We'll be back to these topics, and we, of course, welcome yours. We have been listening to Ira Fussfeld and Barbara Lombardo and Judy Patrick, and I'm Rex Smith. We are grateful to our producer, Dave Gustina. Most especially, we're grateful to you folks for joining us here. And we hope you'll come back next week once again for The Media Project.
I'm going to go out and see if the eclipse is still going.
Yeah, let's check it out. The story's not over until it's over.
Then Yogi said that.
They used to work like hell just for romance. But finally, the movies notwithstanding, they all got tired of patches on their pants. They organized a union to get a living wage. They joined with other actors upon a living stage now.
The Media Project is a national production of WAMC, Northeast Public Radio. This week's projectors include former Times Union editor and current Substack columnist of the Upstate American, Rex Smith, Judy Patrick, former editor of the Daily Gazette and vice president for editorial development for the New York Press Association, Barbara Lombardo, the former editor of the Saratogian and a journalism professor at the University at Albany, and Ira Fussfeld, publisher emeritus of the Daily Freeman. You can listen to The Media Project anytime at wamcpodcast.org or anywhere you get your podcast. I'm your producer, David Gustina. Thanks for listening.
Never has complained. Ah, but publishers have worries, for publishers must go to working folks for readers and to big shots for their dough. Now publishers are such interesting people. It could be prostitution, I don't know. Ting-a-ling-a-ling, circulation, ting-a-ling-a-ling, advertising, get those readers, get that payoff. What a headache, what a mess. Oh, publishers are such interesting people. Let's give 3 cheers for freedom of the press.